Some of the more common ideas about Christians are that we're all rather bland and nice, and possibly idiots. Love one another becomes don't cause any offence. Turn the other cheek becomes let everyone stomp all over you. Having faith means turning off your brain and never doing anything that might cause a fuss. Nice Christians avoid conflict, mind their manners, don't think too much, and sing pleasant songs on a Sunday. At least, this is what many people I encounter seem to think about us. Those of us who actually are Christian, I hope, know better. Because anyone who thinks that faith is about being nice and polite and being a bit thick hasn't been reading their Bible. Or if they have, they haven't been paying much attention. So let's look at one of the granddaddies of our faith, Jacob. What sort of man was Jacob? Well, a few weeks ago, we heard that he was so eager to receive a blessing that he covered his forearms with goat skin to impersonate his hairy older brother. Then he took a special meal into his ageing dad, whose sight was failing. And with his fake hairy arms, he pretended to be his brother Esau, and he fed the old man. And then he tricked him into giving Jacob the blessing that was meant for Esau. And once given, the blessing was non-refundable. When his brother Esau found out, he was justifiably furious. He vowed to kill Jacob. And so tonight we meet Jacob on the run. So one of the forefathers of our faith is a trickster, a liar, and a thief who stole his brother's blessing. Full of chutzpah, he's a real no-goodnik. You could even say he's a crafty asylum seeker with a price on his head. And we meet this manipulative schmuck as he settles down for the night and rests his head on a stone. While he's sleeping, he sees a stairway reaching between heaven and earth, and angels going up and down the stairs. Then the Lord appears to him and promises him land and descendants and his continued presence. You might have noticed that the promises aren't conditional. God makes no comment on the way Jacob tricked his brother and his father. God makes no judgment on him. And God asks nothing of Jacob in return. Instead, God meets Jacob right where he is, fleeing, vulnerable, and possibly quite unrepentant about his earlier behaviour. When Jacob wakes, he renames the place Bethel, or House of God. And so we see that a conniving, striving, ordinary bloke snoozing in a rocky and ordinary place can be touched by God and can wake up to God's presence in the world. Even so, Jacob never became what we think of as nice. He went on tricking and plotting his way through life, although he almost met his match in his uncle. Of course, Jacob wasn't a Christian, but he was a faithful person and one of our ancestors. And I think the point holds. That is that faithful people aren't always nice or polite, and God's not asking that of us. Why do people think we Christians should be nice? I think one reason is that ever since the 4th century, when the Emperor Constantine realised that Christianity could unite his empire, Christianity has been co-opted by the powerful. And so as a nominal religion of the dominant culture, in our country, it's become confused with the dominant class and its values. And so Christianity is linked with middle-class values, non-confrontational politeness, and respect for authority. A second reason people think Christians should be nice arises from a misunderstanding of love. In our world of Hello Kitty and pink love hearts, romantic comedies, pop music, no-fault divorce, love is pretty nice. This love is about romance and self-fulfillment and feeling good. When it begins to cost too much, we move on. Such love is associated with warm, fuzzy feelings and a vague, ambient wafting of general goodwill, rather than with something that is direct and costly and difficult. Since Christians are called to love, many people confuse this with feeling uncritically squishy towards the world and those in it. And so it's no wonder that we Christians are seen to be nice, mild, and naive idiots, when we're not seen to be total hypocrites. And it's not just people outside the church who make this mistake. Those of us in the church often also fall for it. We often hold our tongues. We let people ride over us or treat us with contempt, and then we grumble behind their backs rather than challenge their behaviour. We avoid conflict rather than engaging in the slow, hard work of making peace. We don't say what we think for fear of the opinions of others. We avoid politics, pretending they can be separate from our faith. In the worst cases, we ignore warning signs and overlook behaviours that are later found to be abusive. We all can be way too nice. But what is the alternative? I'm not suggesting that we roll up our sleeves and go at hammer and tongs whenever we disagree with someone. And nor am I saying that we should react every time somebody steps on our toes or does the wrong thing. As Jesus' parable of the weeds and the wheat made clear, we're not to weed the sinners out from among us. If we even tried, we'd damage the whole crop, good wheat and all. Instead, we are called to love, just not in a squishy Hallmark kind of way. Instead, we're to love with integrity and truthfulness. There are many times when learning to live with love will feel quite delicious, as some of us experienced last night at Table Church. But often love will require a clear and unflinching gaze. Love often involves decisions of the head, not the whims of the heart. We choose forgiveness. We opt for kindness. We recognise our fears and refuse to let them drive us. Real love talks back to power when power fails to protect the vulnerable. Real love holds us accountable, not with malice, but with a desire to see each other grow into maturity and into life in abundance. Real love comes at a cost. As Paul knows through representing victims of clergy sexual abuse, love means being weighed down by horrific stories and having your name slandered by religious authorities. As Samara found out when protesting our government's treatment of asylum seekers, love means being threatened with arrest. And as people in more violent parts of the world experience every single day, speaking love back to power can mean jail, death threats, or even summary execution. Love is hard work. As we parents learn, love means setting clear expectations and boundaries and enforcing them gently but firmly over and over again, even when we're being driven out of our minds. As people in committed relationships discover, love means dealing with one's own baggage and letting the loved one deal with theirs. As church leaders find out, love includes recognising and naming destructive behaviours and calling people to account, and being willing to be held to account ourselves. Real love, love like this, is never about being nice and polite or avoiding conflict or colluding with the authorities. It's not about feeling benign or parking one's brain at the door. This sort of love demands intelligence and courage and the willingness to hand everything to God. Our gifts, our resources, our good names, our pride, even our shadows and the weeds in the field. God sowed the good seed, and God will reap the harvest, taking what's a blessing and burning away the rest. Of course, course, none of us can ever love fully like this. Only Jesus, the new human, managed that. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Jesus was the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. We're his disciples, and so we have to follow him in this way of love. And as we learn to love more and more, we'll grow into fullness of life and maturity. But we won't become bland, plastic people, super nice and super polite. Even after his encounter with God, Jacob was still Jacob. The man who tricked his father went on to trick his uncle. The younger son who stole the blessing continued to subvert things, granting the largest portion of his estate to a younger son, and the greater portion of his blessing to his youngest grandchild. The story of Jacob shows us that people of faith are complex and flawed and essentially themselves. Jacob also embodies another aspect of faith, that God always confounds our expectations and turns things on their heads. The younger son is granted the blessing, the first will be last. Happy are the poor, the sick, and those who weep. I came not to call the righteous, but the sinners. Love your enemies as you love yourselves. Such a story, such a faith, should be deeply shocking to those of us who are nice and polite, who work for our rewards, and who think that love can be earned. Because the story of Brer Jacob shows us differently. For all of his trickery and all of his striving, he received the ultimate blessing not when he was grasping for it, but when he was asleep. And in the same way, there's nothing we can do to earn God's presence or God's blessing or God's love. But when we let down our defences, when we give up striving, when we're vulnerable, then who knows what will happen? In some rocky place, we too might dream of angels and wake to the presence of God. It may fill us with awe or courage or fear. It may overwhelm us with gratitude. It may flood us with love. But the one thing I can guarantee you is it will not make us nice.